I'm Phelan McAleer.
And I'm Anne McElhenney.
And welcome to the Harvey Weinstein Trial Unfiltered, a daily podcast looking at the Harvey Weinstein trial in Manhattan, New York.
And we have a bonus feature today for our audience. We have we're welcoming Dr. Elizabeth Loftus to the podcast, who recently gave expert testimony for the defense in the Harvey Weinstein case. Welcome, Dr. Loftus.
Thank you.
Dr. Loftus, I want to just give our audience some of the background about who Dr. Loftus is.
Well, one thing I would say is if we were to list all her qualifications,
we'd be here forever.
It would be the full podcast. So we're going to try and give...
just a little taste of it, but that's actually a really good point, Phelan, because Dr. Loftus has a very lengthy and impressive CV. She is the Distinguished Professor of Psychological Science and Law at UC Irvine, a member of the National Academy of Sciences.
And let's just explain what the National Academy of Sciences are. It's a very prestigious post, and I think, as Dr. Loftus said in the court, if your field doesn't have a Nobel Prize, that the member of the National Academy of Sciences is the highest honor you can get. So, and Dr. Loftus is one of the nation's leading experts on memory, and has been an expert witness or consultant in hundreds of criminal and other style cases.
Including the McMartin preschool molestation case.
Yeah, the satanic abuse trial, which many people would remember her for. But she's been in other trials, Oliver North, Rodney King, a whole list. But the reason, you know, we have come across her is obviously because, Dr. Loftus, you gave evidence in the Harvey Weinstein case. First of all, did we introduce you properly? Did we get all your qualifications? And we want to start off talking about the case and then your wider work. So can you tell our listeners what you were testifying about in the Harvey Weinstein case, and perhaps more importantly, what you were not testifying about? Because that's important. And I think, you know, what weren't you an expert in there, and what were you an expert in the case?
Well, my expertise is in human memory. And in particular, I study the malleability of memory. I study how it is that people remember things differently from the way they actually were, or even how they can create entire memories for experiences that did not happen. And that's the essence of the scientific work that I have been doing and publishing for four decades. Mm-hmm. And so my testimony was really the nature of memory. It was a very scientific testimony. I did not mention any particular individual. I did not opine about the credibility of any particular individual. It was basic scientific information that the jury could or choose or not choose to use to evaluate what they were hearing.
Yeah, I think that's very important for our listeners to understand. You know, they're very familiar now at this stage with the characters from this trial: Jessica Mann, Annabella Sciorra, all the accusers, and Harvey Weinstein, the defendant. But you were not talking about their accounts or what they said or what they didn't say. You were saying, this is something you should know about memory, particularly
in general,
but particularly, you know, one of the accusations is something that happened 27 or 28 years ago. Annabella Sciorra does not know what year it was. So you said, here are things you need to know about memories of events 27 or 28 years ago. You talked, and I think a lot of your testimony was about post-event information, which is significant in this trial because there's been a lot of post-event information. Can you talk about, I think if I remember correctly, you talked about media post-event information, law enforcement, therapy, post-event information. Could you just give us a little summary of how post-event, what post-event information is and how it can affect your memory?
How it works.
Because go ahead.
When somebody, you know, sees an accident or sees a crime or experiences some event, after the event is completely over and the memory, you know, begins to fade a little bit or even a lot over the course of time, sometimes people are exposed to new information And when that new information is suggestive or biased or misleading in some way, it can alter or contaminate or distort somebody's memory. That is a phenomenon that's now in the psychology textbooks. It's called the misinformation effect, where if you get misinformation, it can contaminate or transform your memory. So that's the basic phenomenon that that I was talking about during my testimony.
It's. I mean, I obviously we've been reading a lot about you, and I think it's very. And as I was reading through the thing about rescuing, one of the things that you have done is where you've done an experiment and made people believe that they actually rescued a cat when they hadn't rescued a cat. And as I was reading it, I was saying to Phelan, you know, God, I don't know, I might have actually rescued a cat. And it's really interesting because you kind of almost want to please maybe the person who's asking the question as well. And I thought that work that you did as well about the mall, about the idea that, you know, that you would question people about whether or not they had been, lost in a mall and then found by
as a child
and found by a stranger. And that, you know, you had a very big success rate in getting people to actually think that had happened.
To falsely remember.
And I thought it was very interesting as well. And maybe you could tell people that story, and I know it's upsetting actually for you, but the fact that in your own life this was actually done to you in a way where you were at I think one of your relative's funerals, and an uncle suggested to you that said to you, you know, you were there, you were the one who found your mother, and do you want to tell people that story rather than have me tell it?
Well I don't mind but just to set the stage for the story, you mentioned the Lost in the Mall study. That was one of my earliest studies in which we distorted. We didn't just distort memory for an event that actually happened, but we actually planted an entire memory into the minds of otherwise healthy, normal adults, making them believe and remember that when they were 5 or 6 years old, they were lost in a shopping mall. They were frightened and crying and ultimately rescued and reunited with the family. So I and of course many other scientists began doing these studies where we planted these very rich false memories, and they're now called rich false memories. And one day somebody accidentally did this to me. I went to a birthday, the 90th birthday party of one of my relatives, and a different relative said to me something like, you know, you were the one who found your mother's body when you were 14 years old and she drowned in the swimming pool. And I said, no, I was not the one who found her body. Her sister did, my aunt. But this relative was so insistent that I thought, well, you know, maybe I did, and maybe I somehow forgot it or repressed it or something happened to it. I went home, I started to visualize it, and I started to feel like I was remembering actually finding her. And then the relative called up a few days later and said, you know, I made a mistake. It wasn't you. You're right. Mm-hmm. It was your aunt who found your mother's body.
But an amazing, you know, you were, I think, you know, you were a grown up at that stage. You had been working in this area at this stage as well. And I think it obviously very powerfully proved the point.
To bring it back to our listeners, I mean, it made me think afterwards about politicians who embellish stories. And, you know, you had the famous, I mean, many politicians are famous for this, and I suppose it makes me think now, but even unpopular politicians or people, you know, like Hillary Clinton talked about flying into Bosnia
under gunfire.
Right. And she didn't.
Yes.
She didn't. Right. She flew into Bosnia after a war. And, you know, there'd been a lot of tension and there'd been a lot of media. You know, this is post-event information, a lot of media, a lot of, you know, maybe she talked. They were talking around the table about how we're going to show your foreign policy experience, your courage, Bosnia, war zone, and all this thing. And then at a speech, this came out as flying into Bosnia under gunfire. And, you know, many people might not like Hillary Clinton, and they may, you know, and many may not like politicians and say they're liars. But actually, when you think about this post-event information, it makes you look at politicians in a slightly less cynical way now, because they get lots of post-event information. They get lots of media attention, media descriptions of what they have done. And if it's inaccurate, then they may accept it as real.
Well, I know a lot, quite a bit about that example with Hillary Clinton. And, you know, to her credit, when she was shown photos and videos mm-hmm. of that landing in Bosnia that showed that it was a very peaceful greeting ceremony, mm-hmm. there were children there. She was with her daughter, Chelsea, and she apologized. Yeah. She mm-hmm. said, you know, I had a different memory.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I apologize.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yes. I mean, yeah. So I want to talk a bit more about... am I correct? There's three main post-events information. There's four. There's media, law enforcement, therapy, and other people who were there with you, or other people who may be part of a support group. Am I missing any other who help you?
Well, I mean, the main thing that often happens with people who are involved as witnesses in legal cases is they talk to other people, they get media coverage. They get interrogated by an investigator who may have a bias and may communicate that bias and ask leading questions that can negatively affect somebody's memory. Mm-hmm. Those are just some of the examples out there in real world cases that I have been involved in before.
Yeah, so you wouldn't be as familiar with the Weinstein case as we would, or as many of our listeners would, although I believe you are listening to the podcast now. But I mean, it's,
well, you're right. I was not sent any police reports the kinds of documents that I often have, when I am consulting on a case, it was just a pure, basic science of memory.
Yeah. I mean, there is no case in recent history that has had as much media.
Yes.
And also as much media shaping of a story. Right. And there is no case where so many people have told their stories to the media, other people who were there. And you can see how that could shape the perception of someone about something that happened 27 years ago. And you talk about law enforcement questioning. So this gets a little bit explicit if anyone out there doesn't want to hear this. But in one example... was Lauren Young was the witness. So there's a lot of talk about Harvey Weinstein being intersex and having no testicles and et cetera. And when Lauren Young was questioned in Los Angeles, she said, no, he's not deformed, he's perfect. And it was only after repeated law enforcement questioning about his genitalia that she said, yes, maybe I think he's deformed, actually. And the deformation she described is different from...
the deformation that was described by others.
So it was repeated law enforcement questioning that got her to remember this vital piece of information. And then, I mean, the therapy, the most shocking case of all...
In the Harvey Weinstein case, the most shocking one is where one witness had such a fragmented memory originally when the prosecution... The memories were so fragmented that it said, you're unusable.
The DA wrote to her lawyer and said, your client's memories are so fragmented, we cannot bring this case to trial.
However,
you should go and visit this recommended memory/psychiatrist/therapist. After 55 visits to that therapist, her memory was then sufficiently strong and her story was sufficiently robust to be used in court. So what do you think about those examples?
I think they're kind of classic examples. If the facts support the story as you've told it, it's a perfect illustration of how post-event information can change somebody's memory. I'd be curious, and you would know this, and I don't, because I have, was not allowed to be in the courtroom during other days, but Did all this come out? Did the 55 sessions of psychotherapy come out?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and a lot of there were you know, obviously I think that's the reason why they called you, because memory became a very important part of this whole trial, where people would report their interactions with Harvey Weinstein, but as time went on, the stories got more embellished, and more details suddenly emerged that of things that were never told before, and quite dramatic things were not told in a first telling, but then as time went on, and as the time got closer to the trial, new information was being added.
And negative.
And negative information, but new information being added to a story.
But that 55 visits to a therapist was talked a lot about during the witness's testimony. Yeah,
we were quite shocked by that.
Okay, so what, do you two, with all your vast knowledge of this case, do you have any predictions about what's going to happen? Here?
It's very difficult. I mean,
I think it's very hard to imagine that there'll be that getting a unanimous verdict will be. I think it'll be very hard. I just think there's a lot of holes in a lot of the stories of the main accusers. The two main accusers have stories that are hard for in, you know, because basically the bar that you need to pass is this, you know, is a common sense bar beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think it's hard. It's still a high bar if you have a situation like these situations where these women had such interactions, such loving interactions with their alleged rapist after the event, and I think it's going to be hard for.
However, just to sound a note of from the other side, you know, at the end of the day, you have a jury that were left. These were women are very upset, a lot of them were crying, a lot of them were hysterical. I mean, I think you said something there that struck me in court. What was that phrase? That false memories could be really strong.
Oh yeah, no, that's right. That a false memory could be. I think it's we're probably butchering the way you said this, but somehow that a false memory could be told very passionately. Could be, and the person somehow almost believes it to be true, and so they tell it very powerfully, very convincingly. Are we saying that correctly?
Yeah. Well. I think that what you're trying to say and doing a pretty good job is that. False memories can be experienced with a lot of emotion.
Yes.
And this has been shown in some scientific studies where, you know, in one study that was actually done by one of my former PhD students, Dr. Kara Laney, she planted false memories of things that would have been upsetting if they actually had happened, mm-hmm. and then got the emotional reactions of people. To their false memories, and they were very strong. And then you have some work, a really beautiful work by Dr. Richard McNally from Harvard, who studied people who have memories of being abducted by aliens. Mm-hmm. Many people believe that this happened to them.
Yeah.
And others would say, you know, these are probably false memories that you were taken up on a spaceship and, you know, sexually experimented upon and return to your bed on Earth. Mm-hmm. Those individuals are very emotional when they are remembering. I call it remembering when they are thinking about their abduction experience.
Amazing. So, you've given evidence from cases from the McMartin preschool. You know, satanic abuse.
I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Phil.
Sure.
I was a consultant in the McMartin. Case. I didn't actually testify in the trial, but I worked on the case heavily.
But I suppose you've worked on that case, you've worked on the OJ case, and you've worked on the Weinstein.
Well, I consulted briefly on that case, but did not testify.
Do you ever feel, how do you feel about giving evidence, say, in the defense of someone who is really, really unpopular, or someone who is a monster in the popular...
in the popular perception.
This was very hard for me in this particular situation because he is so unpopular, and my biggest worry was that it would in some way hurt my ability to help other people in the future.
Hmm. Okay.
Particularly other people in the future who I believe there, you know, may. be innocent.
Yes, and may need your help. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And need help. And was this in some way going to subtract from that ability? That was my biggest concern. But I felt if I turned this down because of my own fears about something that might happen to me, I would feel like a coward, mm-hmm. and I'd have to live with that feeling about myself that I did not want to experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we apparently now you we've been talking by email, you've experienced some blowback to your apparent blowback to your giving evidence. It was announced on Thursday that you were going to be given evidence on Friday, and on Thursday afternoon you received an email from New York University. Tell us about that.
Well, I had been scheduled to give a distinguished lecture at NYU in April. The plans had been in place for a long time. The airline tickets were purchased. The trip was all planned, and I got an email saying, due to circumstances beyond our control, we have to cancel your lecture. And I have not been able to get an answer as to the reason, but I'm suspicious. Mm-hmm. And the reason I told you two about it is because I thought maybe with your journalistic skills, mm-hmm. you can investigate and find out.
We tried. I wrote to the public affairs officer at NYU asking for is this correct, and what were the circumstances beyond their control? And I sent that email several days ago and have received no response, which is unusual, actually, that normally they send you either a bland no comment or a non-response, but we've received no response as of yet. Several days later. So
that has been my experience too, after two attempts to find out, you know.
Well, it's very disappointing, and I'm hoping, you know, that we're wrong, and that you're not like the Harvard professor.
So what is your feeling about what's happened? How do you view this cancellation?
I think somebody got, you know, scared, or somebody did not like the idea of honoring a Weinstein defense witness with a distinguished lecture exposure or title, or I don't know. Did who is it? I mean, I really have no idea at this point. It's a mystery. But it's sad because the university is obviously, if they're the place where we should be open to, conflicting ideas and conflicting points of view, and be open to learning from each other what other points of view might be.
Yeah.
So it's disappointing.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's very concerning.
It reminds me actually of the, are you familiar with the Harvard professor, Ronald Sullivan Jr., who was going to join the
Weinstein legal team and got enormous blowback at Harvard. The students protested, and in fact,
the university.
To the level where the university have actually relieved him of his position as a faculty dean, him and his wife, in fact, just for the mere fact that he wanted to join the legal team, which was kind of an amazing precedent
Are you familiar with that? Kiss.
Not only am I very familiar with that and was quite disappointed in, you know, Harvard's actions, but that is what prompted me to go to my deans and warn them that this was happening. Mm-hmm. And when I went to my law school dean, I do have an appointment in the law school as well as the psychology and the criminology departments. She herself was kind of furious about what had happened to Ron Sullivan. And she said to me, all I could say to you is, if somebody interviews you, I just want you to hold a sign up over your head that says UCI law.
Oh, that's good for her.
Yeah, good for her. Yeah. And I want to kiss her.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, well done. What do you think this kind of blackballing, what kind of effect will it have on people who are asked to give evidence going forward?
Well, so, you know, many people already don't like the hostility of being an expert witness and having to face cross-examination. And many people just refuse to engage in this kind of activity because it can be unpleasant. This is just going to add to the problem.
Yeah.
But and you know, I did say to somebody, you know, who was complaining, I think it was another journalist interview or something. I said, well, do you think we should just let the media produce the verdicts and just have trials with no witnesses and no documents?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, that could be the way it's going. I mean, it's also your lecture being cancelled. It's going to have an effect on universities and students now who are not going to hear from distinguished professors such as yourself because you're giving evidence that defends unpopular people. Or, you know, not even defends unpopular people, but warning for the need for evidence when prosecuting unpopular people. How is this going? I mean, do you think that universities are becoming narrower when they're canceling lecturers like you?
I just don't know. You know, I had a very good experience at UC Irvine mm-hmm. when I talked to my two deans. I also, because of the student reaction at Harvard, on the first day of my class, I told my class, this may happen. And I just want you all to know that you can, if this makes you uncomfortable, you can drop this class today with no penalty. I've got a long waiting list. Other people want to get in. And nobody dropped. So
that's a comfort. So
it's hard to predict.
Yeah.
What's going to happen at the next place?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we've talked about the future. I want to talk about the McMartin case now. Actually, it's probably your most famous case. I think you know your most famous where you not as much made your name, but. There was a definite need for someone to shout stop at that stage. It was not a popular call. It was not a popular theory that you advanced. Tell us about that. And because a lot of people don't remember the satanic abuse scare of the 80s and 90s.
You've got to go way, way back because I think Ray Buckey was arrested in 1983. And he and teachers and owners of this McMartin preschool in Manhattan Beach, California, were accused of abusing, ritualistic abusing all of these young children. And these very, very bizarre stories and tales were drummed up, I believe, through highly suggestive questioning on the part of adults. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, over two trials and millions of dollars, there were no convictions. But after the McMartin case in California, that expensive case, and again, I just consulted on the case. I didn't actually testify, but that we began to see little McMartins cropping up in other parts of the country, in Minnesota, in New Jersey, in San Diego, and you know, these poor defendants got ensnared in these daycare preschool cases that innocent people went to prison. And I think many of them are now freed, but their lives were
destroyed.
Destroyed. And a lot of wonderful journalists covered this satanic panic.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Okay. Well, and any other questions?
No, I think, but I have to say, we have a podcast, by the way. We normally live in Los Angeles. We would love to have you on our podcast. We live in Venice, California. So maybe we should try and do that one of these days.
We'd love to talk more generally
about these stories because they are fascinating. And I think actually in relation to that McMartin case, I think a case very similar to that has just happened in Australia. And luckily, I think it's been, it was dismissed.
Well, it took years.
And it took a while.
Yeah.
So it was, I think it's a heroic and noble work that you've been involved with, particularly when, as Phelan pointed out, that sometimes these cases are, the mob, you know, have made their mind up, and it's unpopular to go against the
mob.
My
memory of the McMartin case and the satanic abuse panic was that it united the right and the left. Liberals were believed it, and so did the evangelical right. And, you know, that...
Then you had nowhere to hide.
You had no,
constituency that was backing up the
truth.
That
was a brave call then, because it was the very popular consensus, and people united behind this idea that there was wide-scale satanic abuse in America.
Right, well, and... You know, I hope while you're at it, you will talk to some of the other people who got, you know, these sad defendants who ended up having to go to trial, sometimes being convicted, like Kelly Michaels in New Jersey, or Dale Akiki in San Diego, or people in North Carolina and Minnesota. I mean, just lives were destroyed through these absurd accusations.
Awful. It's amazing. We think we're so forward and so progressive and so advanced, and we fall for the oldest.
Oh yeah, the Salem witch trials all over again. Yeah, you think you're living, as you say, in enlightened times, and this could happen to you.
Yes.
Very scary. But your work in telling the truth and exposing what is possible, with implanting false memories is just heroic stuff. And we're really grateful for your time today, Dr. Loftus. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for coming on.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.